Hello, everyone. Welcome back to this latest episode in the 2021 Roundtable series, sponsored by Sansa Training. I'm Jonathan Farrington. I'm the CEO of JF Initiatives and Director of Research at the Sansa Research Centre. Now, today's topic for discussion is it's been even tougher at the top. And if you haven't seen the preview text, I said, for the last two roundtables, we've examined the future of live versus online events. And then in February, the pressure that sales leaders are under. So for this next one, we want to discuss the challenges that the men and women at the top have faced and how they've battled through. Now, we know that in the early weeks of COVID-19 crisis, organizations all over the world scrambled to make sense of the rapidly evolving situation and its implications, of course. Their focus on protecting the health and safety of their employees, families, and communities was the overwhelming necessity. That was followed by a rush to preserve the business and its ability to sustain operations and its workforce. Now, businesses are re-engineering to emerge from the crisis. While some are still looking merely to survive, others are actively looking at how they might reimagine their business model and return stronger than they were. So will 2021 be a tipping point? Well, we're entering a new phase, and whether we call it restarting, rebuilding, or reimagining, senior executives are now taking a more holistic and deliberate approach to what comes next. Our panel today consists of CEOs who have nervously, but bravely, and possibly fearlessly, steered their ships through the choppy waters of COVID-19. So please allow me to introduce my guests. First of all, David Matson. Dave is a best-selling author and sales and management thought leader, keynote speaker, and leader for the sales training seminars around the world. As CEO and president of Sansa Training, he oversees the corporate direction and strategy for the company's global operations, including sales, marketing, consulting, alliances, and support. His key areas of focus are sales leadership, strategy, and client satisfaction. Since joining Sansa in 1988, Dave has guided the firm to its position as a global provider of sales and management training with over 250 operating units in 30 countries. Dave has actually served on Sansa's board of directors since 1995, and during his tenure with the company, he's been quoted extensively in national industry magazines and newspaper articles, including those running in Forbes, the Wall Street Journal, and the Harvard Business Review. Finally, I have to tell you that he has also written a number of books, including 5 Minutes with Vito, The Sandler Rules, Sandler Success Principles, The Sandler Rules for Sales Leaders, Sandler Enterprise Selling, The Road to Excellence, 6 Leadership Strategies to Build a Bulletproof Business, and most recently, Scaling Sales Success, 16 Key Principles for Sales Leaders, which has received a tremendous reception. So welcome to you, David.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Always a pleasure. My next guest is Bob Apollo. He's a fellow Brit. He's also a fellow of the Association of Professional Sales, a member of the Sales Enablement Society, a regular contributor to the International Journal of Sales Transformation and the Sales Expert Channel. And he's the founder of Inflection Point Strategy Partners, a leading UK-based B2B value selling expert. Following a successful corporate career spanning startups, scale-ups, and market leaders, Bob now works as a proactive advisor, coach, and trainer to a growing number of ambitious B2B-focused sales organizations, enabling them to systematically transform their sales effectiveness by adopting the proven principles of value-based selling. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you, Jonathan. Very happy to be here.
It's really interesting to hear an English voice. Good. Next up, Kevin Eikenbury. Kevin is recognized world expert on leadership development and learning and is the chief potential officer of the Kevin Eikenbury Group. He spent more than 25 years helping organizations across North America and leaders from around the world on leadership, learning, teams, and teamwork, communication, and more. He was named by Inc.com as one of the top 100 leadership and management experts in the world and has been included in many other lists. He's the author, co-author, or contributing author to nearly 20 books, including Remarkable Leadership, the best-selling From Bud to Boss, Secrets of Successful Transition to Remarkable Leadership, The Long Distance Leader, and his most recent, The Long Distance Teammate. And as you might imagine, his blog is consistently ranked among the world's best and most read on leadership. Welcome to you, Kevin.
Greetings from Indianapolis, Jonathan. Glad to be here.
It's always good to have you. And last but certainly not least, Jay Mitchell. Jay is an accomplished entrepreneur and sales and marketing thought leader who has invested the past 20 plus years unleashing the revenue performance of market leaders worldwide, including Ariba, Pitney Bowes, Accel KKR, Ace Hardware, E2Open, Adaptive Insights, Miller Hyman, Alex Partners, SAP, and many, many more. He served in a variety of roles during his career, including President, CEO, CRO, CMO, Board Member, and Investor to over 150 innovative champions. As Merio's founder and president, Jay brings a passion for helping companies align their marketing and sales infrastructure with a heart for serving clients. Jay's other focus values are inspiring to his clients and peers alike, as reflected in Merio's purpose, which is quite simply, seek to serve, not to sell. Welcome, Jay.
With you. Good to be with the other gentlemen too.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. And there they are, four good men and true. Okay, well, look, let's kick off. Dave, I'm going to start with you because we speak regularly. I know precisely what you've done since March last year, 2020, and before that. But will you share with us some of the things that have proven successful as a CEO and some of the things that you moved on very, very quickly? For me, you know, in cricketing parlance, you never stood still and played a straight bat. You got on the front foot straight away, and of course, it paid considerable dividends.
Sure. Well, I mean, if we take ourselves all the way back, I think, you know, no one really knew what we know today. So when your clients dried up overnight, literally, I mean, there was just an absolute freeze on spend. You're in protection mode, making sure that, you know, you do what you can to protect the organization. You know, for me, I've been here 30 some odd years, and it kind of felt like you're on the 5-yard line and, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? We're going to lose all the things that you've worked for over these years. And, you know, the employees who have been with us for many, many years, you know, they too. So, you know, I have a playbook, you know, I'm a big playbook guy. I went right back to the 2008 playbooks, and I just had I followed a process when we get hit by the economy back then. And so we made some very quick changes. You know, we very quickly pivoted. And what I found, just to answer your question very succinctly, is we did an awful lot of over-communication. We just over-communicated. This is what we're doing. Here's why we're doing it. And then I would look at the business every 30 days or so and made new decisions. So we would continually be flexible depending on what was going on in the marketplace and the competitive landscape.
Yes, but there was an awful lot of courage. And courage is a word I use a lot when thinking about leadership. People, as you can imagine, quite often ask me, what is the most essential characteristic of a leader? And I always say courage, because, you know, if you think about the great leaders in history, all of them were courageous. But I mean, there was a lot of courage in the way that you pushed on. You didn't shelve things. You may have sort of cut them back a little or restrained them, but you were, again, very much on the front foot, weren't you?
Yeah, I mean, we shifted overnight. So from literally within 6 days, we went from 100% face-to-face, not 100%, but let's say the majority, to complete virtual. And within that time frame of March to June, I think we did 33,000 boot camps virtually. But then, you know, in addition to us being doing all the right things, I'll use your word courageous. I mean, we really reached out to our client base and made sure, regardless if they, you know, canceled the contract just because they were trying to figure out what to do with their own cash flow, we really made sure that we overserved them. And, you know, that's always the challenge, right, Jonathan? When you're moving forward, you've got the face, the iron face, everything's going to be great, everything's going to be there, because you're inside, it's a complete turmoil inside your head. But you have to still make the good decisions of what's going to get us through whatever that meant at the time. And then where's the puck going? Because there's an awful lot of competitors that were frozen. And so this is an opportunity for those who didn't freeze to say, okay, what are we going to do about this particular situation that is really unprecedented? And so we took advantage of it.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. It certainly wasn't a time for rabbits in the headlights. That's for absolute certain. And now that we've got, I mean, hindsight's a wonderful thing, but, you know, now we've got a year's experience, we can look back and we can identify fairly easily those people that have not just, you know, I use the term again, survive, but actually that are beginning to thrive again, because they were courageous. Bob, in terms of the situation in Europe, and what we noticed, in fact, it's global. We noticed that, you know, more and more organizations suddenly realized the full value of their existing clients simply because there was a paucity of new business out there to begin with. With your clients and with your, you know, with your own actions, you know, did you recognize fairly quickly that was going on, that people were reevaluating their relationships with their existing clients and even placing far greater value on them?
Yeah, very much so. And I think one of the things that some of the clients recognized was that they actually didn't have a particularly good mechanism for managing the relationship with those accounts. You know, they might have a rather formal structure to account planning, but it simply wasn't agile enough to cope with the changing circumstances. And actually, a lot of the conversations were around understanding the customer base and reprioritizing the customer base based on a number of things, on the broad situation of the marketplace that the customers found themselves in, but also to pick up on a point that you raised in your introduction, where each of these customers was on that scale between, you know, being in survival mode and starting, even in the early days, to see some opportunity to, you know, potentially drive a rather more rapid transformation in their business. So I think what I observed was a lot of reprioritization and retargeting, all with the objective of maintaining the customer relationships. I'm also seeing, and this is a trend that I think again has been accelerated, a greater awareness of the importance of outcomes to the customer, and not just thinking that, our job's done when the order's taken and the salesperson moves on. In any environment where retaining, growing, developing the customer's business is important, and I think it clearly is now, we need real clarity, and we need to help the customer see clarity in the value that we're helping them generate, the business outcomes that we're enabling them to accomplish. And maybe those outcomes are, you know, being able to better cope with a changing world. So yes, I think a number of moving parts.
Yeah. No, absolutely. It's very interesting that, you know, it took a pandemic for selling organizations to get much closer to their, you know, most important accounts, to the buyers.
Yeah.
And you may have, what you may have already heard is that our next piece of research from Sander Research Center focuses entirely on buyers. We want to know how buyers are buying today, you know, what causes them to want to get close to vendors, what do they appreciate from vendors, what are the most important aspects of the buying cycle for them. And what I can tell you, after only a week, we've already had hundreds of responses. 84%, okay, And that's a hefty number. 84% regard it as important or very important to create long-term relationships with vendors. And that really does endorse the importance of you know, creating this symbiotic relationship with all of our buyers and particularly our most important accounts, and getting much closer to them and, you know, getting them involved in our decision-making process. And you mentioned sort of first purchase. I've always regarded a first sale or first purchase as being the beginning of a relationship. And I think far too many vendors, I don't know how you feel about this, Bob, far too many vendors sort of think, oh, okay, well, I've got the first order, so they're a client now. If they want me, they'll be back in contact again. I can go and do some more exciting things like finding new logos. Yeah.
Well, it's all a question of what you define as being exciting, of course. One of the things I do see happening, there has been an awareness of the importance of the role that's typically described as customer success, certainly in any as a service business. But when I talk to senior executives about the charter of customer success, you know, some of them are really only focusing on what I'd call the tactical aspects of making sure that the ultimate customer's happy and operational on a day-to-day basis. And I think the more forward-thinking ones are working out how that customer success role is able to both ensure operational excellence and satisfaction in the day-to-day relationship, but also maintain a real perspective on where that customer is going, what their priorities are, and how what we do can align to their emerging, strategic action list.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to come on and I'm going to ask Kevin, who's got considerable experience in coaching, training, speaking, writing books about remote leadership. And so we can discuss just how well he feels that we as CEOs have managed through the past sort of 12 to 13 months. Jay, what I'd like to do is to ask you, first of all, to really comment on Bob's commentary there, because I know that you are a huge advocate, almost a crusader, for creating strong win-win relationships with clients. I mean, what's been your experience over the past 12 to 13 months? I mean, you know, has that really happened as we believe it has?
I think there's been a platform, maybe a different platform than there has been in the past, Jonathan, as Dave and Bob both shared. I mean, we just reached out to clients, and I think that's what we encouraged our clients to do. Personally, I spent probably about the first two or three weeks just talking to past clients, future clients, current clients, talking to their leaders, the CEOs, the CROs, the CMOs, the product leaders, and so forth, and just getting the pulse of what was going on with that. And when you kind of looked at that, there was, when I got into those conversations, the things that came out and what's kind of played out from that has been very, I think that those leaders were very insightful in what was going on. Is they said, you know, the dynamics of how we're buying, how our customers are buying, how we're serving them, that all is changing around that. And there was a different impact across sectors. We have, a client and a real good friend who works in the restaurant industry and sells software and services there. Guess what? That one blew up, and they ended up having to let go, you know, or furlough a number of people from their sales team and across the organization. They've been able to bring a lot back as that's come back online more, but that was much different than companies that were able to capitalize on some of the buying dynamics. Those in virtual workspace software, business continuity, operational resilience solutions. And so there was I think the industry sectors and the dynamics of the changing buyer around that. David and Bob have both commented about the just kind of with that shifting buyer around that. And there's been an opportunity to get closer to them. The virtual nature of this has presented that. I know we just released an article a couple weeks back looking at the differences in executive level engagement between what that was kind of 2019 and early parts of 2020, and what did that look like over the last year, kind of a 12-month basis. There was an organization called Chorus that did a lot of study of 30 million different interactions that were happening, they were monitoring, and executives got much more engaged, almost two times as engaged. But the organizations that took advantage of that and capitalized on that, they made hay. They looked at a different buying dynamic and a different buying committee, different buying knowledge, and that's what we've seen, right? There's been an opportunity to get closer to the customer as a part of this, and those organizations that embrace that have thrived.
Yeah, that's certainly been a huge positive, Jay. I totally agree. Kevin, coming on to you. So let me begin by asking you, first question, how have we done as CEOs managing and leading remotely, do you believe, in the last 12 to 13 months?
Well, it's clearly a mixed bag, right? Ask a big question like that, it's going to be all over the spectrum. I mean, if leaders have taken the advice of the other three gentlemen that you've just heard from, they're in better shape. I think that the CEOs that have done the best through this toughest time will set themselves up for the better or the best futures as well. So everyone's been talking a lot about the customer side of this, and I would echo a lot of the things that everyone has said. But I think there have been some huge lessons for us as leaders, CEOs, and leaders at all levels to take from all of this if we choose to take them. And the first one, I'll sort of just add on to what Jay said about just talking to people. I've been saying for months that this is the age of empathy. And some leaders who maybe never even thought about empathy as an important part of their role have now sort of figured it out, and I hope they don't forget it. And so we've been talking about that empathy and that listening and that checking in and that connection with our customers and prospects, but that also had to happen, needed to happen, should be happening with all of our team members as well.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because in fact, over the last year, several times on roundtable discussions, you know, the word empathy has come into our conversation, and I've written about that quite a lot. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a time, or it hasn't been a time, has it, for Churchillian type speeches. I know you're a big fan of his, but it has been a time for demonstrating empathy and getting closer to our teams and to our staff and to our employees. And some people appear to have done that much more comfortably and easily than others. Wouldn't you agree, Kevin?
Oh, 100%. That's true. And the bright spot I would see is that there's some leaders that we work with and some folks that I coach that maybe if you'd have said on up front who will be comfortable with it, who will take to that, I've been pleasantly surprised with some in terms of people who have recognized that. I've been saying, Jonathan, from the very beginning, that we're all having the same experience, but experiencing it differently. And so leaders that have figured that out, I mean, I'm looking at the pictures of all of us that are here, and none of us are likely being of the general ages that we are, experiencing some of the things that many of our team members and many of our customers are facing. Like, maybe they are living all alone, or maybe they are living and trying to teach school and still be a successful parent and spouse. Like, there's a whole bunch of different stuff that's been going on for people. It's certainly been challenging for us as CEOs, but our challenges have been different in many ways than others. Yeah. So while in some ways we're all having the same human experience, as leaders, we need to recognize that and have needed to, and I think need to continue to, as we look forward at recognizing that we're not all experiencing it the same way. And how do we lead knowing that?
Yeah. I mean, there's several good points that you've made there. It has to be hoped, and you touched on this, that it has to be hoped that, you know, these new, what I would call soft skills, that we've learned during this period, or many people have learned, if they didn't already have them, it's to be hoped that they endure, that we manage to keep them and we hang on to them. And then, you know, if anything goes back to anything like a normal, and we won't use the word new normal, I promise, but if anything goes back to, you know, any level of normality, that, you know, we just retain those skills and we retain behaving in the same way that we have done. Because at the end of the day, I know all of you agree with me that in order to provide the level of service that our clients and customers require, which is going to be delivered by our teams and our employees, we have to ensure that those teams and employees are fully motivated and are happy in their job and content and are being valued. Because if we don't, things will slip back again. And we've got to hope that that doesn't happen. David, I know that you've done, I'm going to bring you in again now. I know that you've worked very, very hard at increasing levels of communication during this period. Will you share with us and share with the listeners some of the things that you've innovated and that you've put into place to ensure that your teams and not just your customers, you know, are feeling valued?
Sure. So our organization, we have home office employees, and then we have 256 offices that we, you know, obviously are not under the same roof. So what we did was, if I talk about our employees first, we got everybody together. We would have a video, you know, update, we'll call that, every single Friday. And this was what was going on. Then we got together midweek and people got to do Q&A. Each of the department heads would also, making sure that those messages got sent down. Because, you know, Jonathan, when you're running 1,000 miles a minute pre-COVID, let's say, you know, production hides all sins. And you realize that maybe the messaging that doesn't always get, you know, filtered down to every level of the organization that it should. So we just bypassed everybody and went directly to every employee and over-communicated in that fashion. When it came to our field, we did the same thing. We did a couple different things. We sent out, you know, I was doing videos once a week. Here's what's going on. Here's some of the things that are, you know, successes out there, best practices. You know, here's things that we're focused in on, concerned about. And then we have a group of trainers, and we call them the advisory board. So we made sure that the messaging was sent to them. And then each of our regions, we're set up into 9 different regions. They got together. Typically, it would have been 6 times a year. They were getting together every single week. So there's, you know, 60, 70 people on Zoom calls. And they were doing 2 things: sharing best practices, helping others that were not being as progressive as they should be, or accelerating in some of the things that we had suggested. And they kind of dragged each other along, which was awesome, because it's just not always what do you do. A lot of it is they hadn't experienced, as was said, some of the things that we were facing before, whereas others had. So they were sharing best practices, that type of mentorship. And I think one thing that I would be the most proud of is how the field really rallied around each other and helped each other through this period. For instance, those that were not doing remote training, others stepped up and did remote training for their clients on their behalf. And so that type of cooperation really helped us. But we probably had 6 different ways that we were communicating on at least twice a week to everyone that was associated with Sandler outside of our client base. That's how we did it.
Yeah. And I mean, what you've mentioned there, and certainly I've noticed it within Sandler, there's been much more, what would I call it, camaraderie. There's been much more a commitment to team thinking. And it's like, well, look, we're all in this, but we're all in it together. And you know, as you suggested, people have been more than willing to do anything they can to help sort of colleagues. So, you know, there's no sort of lone rangers, or don't appear to be, in your organization, and which is absolutely great. Bob, if I can come on to you, I mentioned in my introduction that, or really I asked the question, will 2021 become a tipping point? There are those in the industry, and this does have an effect at boardroom, because, you know, success and strategy and direction never permeates upwards in an organization, you may have noticed. It always permeates downwards. And I think any, you know, any business leaders that haven't taken this time that they've been allowed to have to re-examine their strategies, their ways to market, their total sort of business offerings, have actually wasted time. Where do you see us going from 2021? I know it's kind of difficult because we don't yet really know until the pandemic is under control. It's a very difficult question to answer, but do you agree with me that what has happened with the changes in the buyer-seller relationship, in other words, we've had to go almost totally digital, do you think that will remain, Bob, or do you think that we will go back to a more sort of hybrid model?
You know, I think that's a really tough call even now, isn't it, to try and work out where the balance is. I mean, I think, and having talked to both you know, groups of salespeople, sales leaders, CEOs, some end user buyers, I think there's an appetite for, a balance point between remote communication and face-to-face communication that's going to look different from what it did prior to the pandemic. And I think certain industries, and if I think of this in terms of sales process, I think certain sales environments will find themselves at different points on that scale, on the level of interaction. One of the things that strikes me sometimes when some of the generalized statistics are created about the sales environment is you've actually got a couple of, I think, really important factors that affect buyer behavior and their interaction with salespeople. One of them is this purchase a inevitable purchase? In other words, the customer simply has no choice. They have to do something. And that would clearly be true if you were, I don't know, running a factory or signing up a provision of electricity to the organization. There's a bunch of other examples, but those are inevitable purchases. The only question is from who, under what terms, and so on. But I think there's a bunch of other buying journeys which are discretionary. And, I think the evidence even before the pandemic, and I suspect afterwards, is that prospective customers are going to expect and want a better degree of interaction when they're on a discretionary sort of purchase rather than an inevitable one. And I think the other dimension then is reading whether the customer thinks of themselves as being in a very familiar buying process, which is very often associated with inevitable purchases, or an unfamiliar buying process. So I think we're going to see, find ourselves at various places on this scale, between face-to-face and remote, between automated digital and human interaction. I think it's going to increase the demand for salespeople who can demonstrate that all-important business acumen, be perceived as trusted advisors, are seen to be genuinely concerned for the customer's success rather than taking the order. This is actually where I see a lot of the training emphasis is, preparing for that environment coming in.
Yeah. Well, with my hand on my heart, and those of you on the panel that have spoken to me in the last 6 months will know this, that I genuinely believe that there was a possibility, a strong possibility, that all sales inevitably would go digital. So we would be online, and face-to-face meetings would be reserved for that very rare, possibly the exploratory meeting stage or the closing T's and C's, et cetera, et cetera. The more people I've spoken to, particularly the more buyers I've spoken to, then I've begun to realize actually that there is going to be a balance. And, earlier on in this discussion, I quoted the latest results from our most recent survey so far. I should add so far, because we're only 1 week in. But do you know something? We asked the question, if what would be, what is likely to be their preferred method of communication with sellers stroke vendors in the future? And it's broadly 50-50. 50% said video or telephone is my preference, and 50% said we want face-to-face. And I think, you know, that's ample proof that we are moving towards this hybrid, isn't it?
And I think also an indication that we need to be able to read what the preferences of our potential customers are and adapt accordingly.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, I've been saying this, again, as some of you know, until I become blue in the face. If you want to know how to sell to your buyers, ask them how they want to be sold to. It's really very, very simple. I mean, because you know, we know the relationships have changed. But I don't think sellers have kept up, but it's another thing. Jay, when you look out to the future as a CEO and, you know, thinking about sort of longer term business strategies and ways to market, et cetera, where do you see us going?
Jonathan, I think as we've talked through here, the hybrid that you were describing, that the study there of that 50-50 dynamics, that balance, I think that's very very much aligned with what I'm hearing from our customers, and also how we're interacting with those customers across the board. And I think when you look at that, there's a couple things that have materialized on that time. I know I mentioned in my previous response that we just ended up reaching out to a lot of different folks and having conversations with them. And the in those conversations, not just the first week or two, but over, you know, over a 6-9 month period there, particularly through the end of the year, the thing that kept coming out was that their employees were obviously had gone virtual, but they were desiring to have some of that human interaction back again, and we're seeking that out. That doesn't surprise any of us, I don't think, because, you know, we've seen that in the school pushes, right? How do we have students do that? How do we have, you know, the employees or people? We all seek that human interaction element there. And maybe it's my West Texas roots, having grown up in a small town in West Texas, but, you know, there's probably purchases of a certain size. I don't know what that variable may be, but as Bob was just saying, maybe it's the variance of discretionary, you know, versus more necessary purchases there. But, you know, there's still something to be said about looking somebody in the eye and shaking their hand, or maybe in today's world, you call it the COVID elbow around that. But, you know, when you grow up in a small town like I did, there still was a ton of business, you know, even 35 years ago, it was done on a handshake around that, right? Yeah. We can't obviously operate in that environment today with the legalities and that kind of stuff, but that doesn't mean people still don't want to, you know, that human interaction is still necessary with that. I saw a study, I think kind of to wrap that thought up around that, Jonathan, I saw a study a couple weeks back that caught my attention, and it was looking at the workday shifts that have happened, and, you know, what are employees doing with that? And as they've gone virtual, David was talking about his team, you know, having with both offices and doing the calls with them and stuff. And the shift has been, there's 80 more minutes per day that employees are investing working. Well, what did they trade that in for? They traded it in for commutes in a lot of cases, right?
Yeah.
And that affords customers, and therefore us, you know, the folks that a lot of us work with, the sellers and the sales teams, that gives us actually more opportunities to interact with those organizations and the people that those organizations have at their disposal. So I think that, you know, from a buying dynamic, there's the virtual piece, like take advantage of the fact that they're more reachable and accessible because they're virtual, but then there's still the human element of, you know, still want to shake a hand at some point too.
Yeah, absolutely agreed. I mean, I know there are a lot of so-called sales commentators within the sales space over the past 12 months that have suggested that everything's going inside. And it did occur to me that that might happen, but I'm completely convinced it's not going to happen now. And yeah, just looking at reading articles and blog posts, and you know, some fairly learned people have suggested that the most successful salespeople at this given time, even though they're selling digitally and they're selling online because they have to, are outside sales professionals, simply because a lot of them, probably most of them, have been used to being based at home anyway. And of course, you know, and then traveling out to meet clients and going into the office once a week. So, yeah, we know that it's a completely different set of skills. So it's going to be interesting to see how it pans out. Now,
Jonathan, you and I have talked about this over the last year a number of times, because yeah. I personally have operated in a home office environment, and even when I was before starting Mario in 2007. So I can go all the way back to 1999, having worked in that home office environment and seen what works and doesn't work with that.
Yeah.
And so when I started Mario in 2007, we ended up embracing more of that virtual environment, frankly, not different than a lot of companies had done over the last year with that. Yeah. And I can't tell you how many phone calls I fielded and conversations I've had of people, you know, we're not in the office configuration business, right? That's not what we do. But I can't tell you how many conversations I've had about how do we support that? How do we do that? You guys have done that. You've done that personally, and you as an organization have been that way for a long time. What is that? And I think folks are, you know, have been able to pivot very successfully there around that for their employees their customers.
Yeah, yeah. I couldn't agree more. And we see daily reports about, certainly here in the UK, we see reports that so many companies are moving out of London. And, you know, they're going to let 80% of their staff or 60% of their staff decide whether they want to work from home full time in the future. I mean, the future is going to be so much different, and we'll just have to see how it all pans out. Now, before I come on to Kevin, what we typically do, and I think you all know this, is we tend to leave the listeners with one solid tip. Okay, so today we're talking about CEOs, we're talking about C-Lounge residents, we're talking about senior management. Moving forward, if you had to, what's one piece of advice you would leave everybody with? Okay, now before I'll give you time to think about that, obviously. Kevin, if I can come back to you, when you're talking to your clients, okay, and from your own thought process, because I know you think about this a lot, are you optimistic about the future? Are you optimistic about the future economy, our ability to, you know, recover and catch up?
Okay, Jonathan, you already know me, so you know what my answer is going to be. I am 100% optimistic. I think the world will be different, but I think we can look at history over the long haul, and I have enough age for perspective and enough knowledge of history to say that, of course, the future will be bright. It will be different for all of the reasons we've been talking about and all of the reasons that we all know, everyone who's listening knows. But I absolutely am optimistic. I think here's, you know, we spend a lot of time doing for a living what Jay just said about, you know, how office configurations and teamwork and leadership and all that. And here's my belief that we lived for, most of us lived in a world of, we all come to the office to work together face to face. And then we were forced 13 months ago or so to all be, or largely to be, remote. And the future is a hybrid somewhere in the middle, right? And I grew up on a farm and serve on the board of a plant genetics company, and plant breeders for hundreds of years have tried to take the best of two plants to bring them together to be something better, a hybrid. Now, not always did they succeed, but that was always the goal. And I believe the future is not at either end of the spectrum for every organization, but is some sort of hybrid in the middle. And we have the opportunity at a moment right now that matters as CEOs to create a future hybrid, whatever that looks like for you, that can actually be better than either what we've always had or what we've had for the last year.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Kevin, I think we're moving to a, hopefully we're moving back to a phase where we'll be split into two groups, as we always have done, glass half full, that's all of us, or glass half empty, whereas we've just spent 12 months being very grateful to have a glass at all, I think. But that's the way it is. David, I know that you are particularly optimistic about the future, aren't you?
Yeah, we are. I mean, we've hired 25% more employees than we had in 2019 at this point in time. We've entered into a couple different marketplaces and made some acquisitions. But, you know, we're doing all the things that, you know, has been talked about thus far. But we are, in our minds, really positioning ourselves for 2021 through 2024. So being very aggressive.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I picked that up. Bob, I mean, we've got over here in the UK, I say over here in the UK because I haven't had a chance to get back to Paris for at least 12 months. We've got people like Andrew Bailey, of course, the governor of the Bank of England, who replaced Mark Carney, being incredibly optimistic about the future and raving about it. And I have to say that the UK economists that I read or keep up to date with or even speak to are also extremely optimistic about Q4 onwards. From 2021. How do you feel about it?
Well, I think it depends sector to sector. I think there's absolutely pent-up demand in some of those sectors, retail, hospitality, etc., that have been depressed by this. I think there is a real backlog of a desire to socialize and so on, to travel just as soon as we can. So I think those sectors will certainly rebound as soon as conditions permit. And I think that will have an effect on the rest of the economy. I mean, you could hardly ignore the Brexit effect. And I think that has caused damage to certainly food chains and so on. And I think that, honestly, the jury's out on that one. But I think there's going to be a COVID bounce. Certainly.
Yeah, I think certainly here in the UK, I've noticed that the two sectors that have been particularly badly hit are obviously hospitality, as you suggest, but also the high street. I mean, the high streets have been decimated, haven't they?
Yep. And there, I think, again, we've got a rebalancing of the hybrid model, haven't we? We've got people who've had to get used to buying online. I know when I talk to, I talk to my wife, hardly my sample of one, she's looking forward to getting back to the high street. But whether or not she and others like her will have quite the same balance of buying it on the high street versus buying it online, I think that's a little uncertain. And I think you're seeing the retailers reflect that in shifting their investments from bricks and mortar to online. In the case of John Lewis, major department store, deciding to close a number of stores and to invest more online. But I do think on the high street there's a knock-on effect. For years there's been this idea of having anchor stores in shopping centres and so on. You know, the traditional department stores that draw the traffic, and I wonder what's going to substitute for them?
Yes, it's going to be interesting. I just think we're moving to a completely different model. There's an air of inevitability about it. I just think that what's happened with COVID has just advanced everything. And I alluded to this earlier. All it's done is advanced it by about 6 years, I believe. Jay, how about you? I think I know only too well that you are, of course, as ever, optimistic about the future.
Very optimistic about the future, I think, as Kevin and David and Bob have all said. There's a lot to be grateful for what we've come through, but a lot of opportunity and optimism around that for the future. To me, when I look at that, I happen to live in Texas and live in the Austin, Texas area here in the States. And there's, I think the thing that jumps out to me is that the companies that we're seeing out there that are capitalizing on that potential are those, you know, that those that have positioned themselves to be flexible, that have set themselves up to do that. And one of the things that I think is can't be ignored is the regulatory environments that afford that flexibility around that. And living here in Texas and in Austin, there's a massive influx from other states in the union here that and that's headquarters, that's people, you know, that are coming to a more commerce friendly capitalistic environments around that. And, you know, people vote with their feet around that. And that's the reality of what we're seeing, is that those restrictions and those restrictive environments that are not, you know, friendly to, communication and commerce and letting business happen around that, people are flooding out of those into ones where it is more friendly. And I think that's a dynamic that can't be ignored as well. Yep. In this.
Yeah. No, I agree. Okay, good. Kevin, I'm going to come on to you for your first pearl of wisdom very shortly, but just sort of staying on that point about sort of, you know, confidence in the future and optimism in the future. The third and final statistic I will share with you from this latest piece of research that we're currently conducting. We asked the question, of the respondents, did they feel that looking forward over the next 12 months, they were likely to be spending less, much less, significantly more? And 91% said that they would be spending the same as they did in 2019. And sorry, 91% said they were either going to spend what they spent in 2019 or spend more. Now, I would say that's very optimistic and is really good news. So, Kevin, on to you. What's your tip?
The next few months are a tremendous opportunity for us as CEOs, as leaders in organizations, because the decisions that we make, a year ago, a decision was made for us, send everybody to work from home. The decision that we have now is voluntary, and it's far more important and far reaching than we probably realize. How are we going to view and create our organization for the future of work? Will have impacts on culture and talent retention and talent acquisition and engagement and connection and many other things. So I just urge every CEO who's listening to take the decisions that you make about reentry and all of however you want to frame that very seriously, because doing it right will have a huge competitive advantage for you moving forward.
Yeah. And you know, we're back to that word again, courage, aren't we? I mean, I think that there are going to be a lot of decisions to be made in the very near future by leaders that are going to require them to be courageous. And, you know, they're just going to have to, you know, bite the bullet. David, what's your tip?
I think the two P's for us, which has helped us get to where we are and really helping us in the future, the two P's for me would be process and partnerships. I think that, you know, when this all hit, you know, you realized that we had gaping holes in process. And so I would suggest to the CEOs, make sure that we're cleaning that up. And process, you know, is not a negative thing. It's just how do we do things and how do we do things in a repetitive way? And then wherever the puck is going for you as an organization based on buying journeys or a competitive landscape, you know, what do we need to have in place to make sure that we can scale and we've got the best of the best? And then as far as partnerships are concerned, I think that's really going to help us as we, you know, go to that next level, is that we've searched out partnerships that together our company and another company can add more value to the end user and then, you know, elevate all three. And I think that's been really important. So I would give those two tips to CEOs as they move forward.
Very good. Another two good ones. Thank you, David. Bob.
Yeah, thank you, Jonathan. So I think my top tip would be something along the lines of reorganize or organize your company around the achievement of customer outcomes. I think we've lived through a situation where, you know, we've got specialized departments marketing, sales, customer success, all of the other departments that can interact with them, where, you know, honestly, the handoffs between those departments have not been seamless. The customer experience has not been, frankly, good enough as a result of that. Even the awareness of what the customer's desired outcomes are and whether or not we're achieving them. So, yeah, organize your company around the successful achievement of customer outcomes.
Yeah, yeah, good one. Okay. And finally, Jay.
As CEOs, we're called, I mean, we find ourselves lots of times put up on a pedestal. We're elevated by employees. You know, customers want to talk to us over others, maybe on our team and all. But at its core, we're as CEOs, as leaders, we're called to be servants. That's the best CEOs are servant leaders when it comes down to it. Not just for their customers, but for their employees, for their families, for the folks around them in doing that. And I think the thing that I keep coming back to that is the word of wisdom I try to anchor on around that and encourage others to anchor on is this idea of seek to serve. And there's a passage in the Bible in Matthew 20 about, you know, whoever is great among you must be your servant. Whoever is wants to be first must be a slave. That's the idea around that is if we want to help the folks around us be successful, the best thing we can do is serve them, seek to serve them as customers, as employees, all those around us. That's the heart of this. And that's really what I think it can kind of be the guidepost that we as leaders and as CEOs can take from this.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. Thank you very much. Well, my final thought on this is I think that most forward thinking leaders, CEOs, senior managers, C-level residents have taken this period of time to re-examine every part of their business, every part of their company. They've conducted a complete commercial audit. And I suspect that many of the results and the findings that they've realized or, you know, have been identified have probably shocked and surprised them. But I would urge leaders everywhere not to take it as a one-off exercise. The most successful leaders I know are constantly re-examining everything they do and coming to work ready to lead their teams with a how can I do this better mentality. And I think the ones that are failing at the moment or the ones that have failed, particularly over the past 12 to 13 months, have been the ones that have put their head in the sand and they've been working with the mantra, this will pass. Well, it will pass. But it your company will not be in any better position than it was when all of this started at the beginning of March last year. The ones that are succeeding and indeed thriving are the ones that have accepted it as a challenge and they've used courage. There's that word again. And they've acted courageously and led their teams. But it doesn't stop here. We don't get from one side to the other. We have to then constantly move to the next stage. And you can only do that with that type of mindset. And so that's what I would urge everyone listening to consider. Okay, well, that leads me to thank the panel for this fabulous, fantastic discussion. And I think it's been great. David Matson, Bob Apollo, Jay Mitchell, Kevin Eikenberry. And I hope all four of you will come back and join the panel at some later stage during 2021 and beyond, of course. So, if you will indulge me, 60-second commercial break. We've made an awful lot of changes to Top Sales World. We've given most of our locations an autonomous home. And will it stay like that? Well, certainly for the next 12 months. And I'll probably want to move the furniture around again. But what we've now got is we've broken out Top Sales Magazine, which has currently got 332,000 subscribers. And although, you know, it wasn't an overnight success, we're coming up to our 11th year, I believe. The Futurists, small group of people, friends and colleagues. In fact, the entire panel are over there. This group of people are looking exclusively at what's to come in the future. They are genuine futurists. They share my passion for the future of professional selling. They really, really care. So I would urge you to get over there if you can. Top sales articles, well, we like to reward good writing, and we do that by choosing the best sales articles, the 10 best or the 10 best blog posts every week. We select a week's winner, we select a month's winner, and then the 12 monthly winners go on to the final at Top Sales Awards for the top post of the year. Sales leadership, top sales leadership. What if there was a time for us to create something that helped all those sales leaders out there that may be floundering and are looking for help, now is the time. And so you'll find that by May the 1st, we will be launching Top Sales Leadership. Top Sales Awards, it's a celebration of the best of the best, and we do it once a year, and it creates a lot of excitement. Top Sales Library is the other one you may not have heard of. That should go live in about 8 days, and it's just jam-packed with articles, white papers, videos, webinars, anything that a frontline sales professional could possibly need. So it's exciting times. So do make your way round our community, please, and just decide where in the world will you go today. So with that, again, I thank the panel, and I have to say thank you very much indeed for joining us. Bye-bye now. Bye-bye.